I'm pleased to be joined today by Dr. Jack Schultz. He's a professor of psychology at Concordia University. Shout out to Dorothy for putting us in contact. Jack is an expert in the cultural anthropology of religion and the sociology of knowledge. Jack, welcome to the Nature and Nurture podcast.
Thank you so much, Adam.
Now, I'm a psychologist and neuroscientist. I don't delve too much into anthropology, but it did make the news recently in a sphere that I was in, because my research on sex hormones and brain development interacts with sex differences, and especially looking at it from a cultural or evolutionary anthropology perspective. I know that there are a lot of people in your field who do research on that. And recently there was some controversy regarding that. I'm not too filled in on the details, but if you'd like to talk about it, we can start there.
Yeah, just how to talk about sex differences, gender, sexuality. It's important to recognize that anthropology splits the road between being a science or being a humanity. Is it an art? Is it a science? Remember that as anthropologists, what our goal is to understand humanity, diversity of human being, how we go about doing the stuff that we do. So whatever kind of resources would allow us to understand a little bit better, that's available to us. I'm a product of a graduate program at the University of Oklahoma, a founding anthropologist. I guess he was the original department head in the anthropology department. Clyde Kluckhohn was his name. And he said a degree in anthropology is a license to poach. And then he went on to elaborate whatever discipline there is, whether it be a hard science, a soft science, poetry, anything dealing with nutrition, biology, theology, psychology, anything that is available that we can use to try to understand humanity, it's available to us. And that's a fun approach. All right. So what we're seeing in this controversy that's coming out is now how to understand these expressions of sexuality and gender. And I think that we have a recognition that there's going to be these two primary poles. One is going to be towards the scientific, let's see if we can do this objectively without so much of the influence of some of our biases or even political orientations. But then on the other side, there's a recognition that yeah, we can speak about science and about it being empirical and limiting the kinds of approaches that we use to what has been recognized as science, but we're still human beings living in context, and the kinds of things we talk about and the conclusions that we make matters. There's plenty at stake here. How do we understand gender? How do we understand sexuality? And I think this is one of those places where we're at odds, even with ourselves. And are we going to take this side that's going to be a little bit more scientific objective, or this side that's going to be a little bit more humanistic in recognizing the kinds of statements we make are going to matter? And I think this is a good example of that.
I like this tension between the scientific side and the humanities side, that in psychology as well, poaching from different disciplines.
That seems to be a more realistic way of doing what we do. I think science is a really good way of knowing some things, but not a good way of knowing all things. And because science does such a good job of applying itself, let's say in terms of technology, right? We can make cell phones that allow us to talk to people on the other side of the planet. We can send rocket ships to Mars and have them send back either information or what recently, even a collection of rocks. Or bridges that don't collapse. All of those are really compelling reasons why we should approach the world scientifically. But at the same time, as human beings, we're much more complicated than that. I don't think we can reduce ourselves simply to these cause and effect explanations. What science does really good is describe. Let's say even mathematics is a really sophisticated way of describing. But it's not a means of explaining. It's a way of simply saying, this is what happens when we do this. How did we get rocket ships to Mars? It's not a matter of explanation. It's instead description. we know that when we fire these rockets and do these thrusts at this rate, it's going to have this effect. Now, that sounds predictive, but it's really descriptive. And to recognize that as human beings, we got a whole lot going on that I feel is not reducible to these simple cause and effect, even materialist explanations. There seems to be another level of humanity, but that's the humanity art aspect of what we do.
Now, when talking about this tension between science and humanities, or between nature and nurture, which we talk about on this podcast, it's not an either or, they're different perspectives to come to a more complete understanding. When you're talking about sex and gender, that's a good example. You have its biological component and you have a sociological component. From what I understand, the controversy wasn't really about proving one side right or wrong, but more like shutting down dialogue from one side in a way that isn't normal. You could imagine, I think what happened, and you could add some details if I'm missing anything, is that there was a panel specifically talking about evolved sex differences contributing to gender differences. And presumably there are going to be plenty of people who disagree with that or think that it's an incomplete story, but both sides can have at it. And then through that, you can arrive at a truth somewhere in the middle. And it was that the talk on one side was actually canceled, so that discussion and finding whatever the truth in the middle wasn't able to happen.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's the same way that I would assess what was going on there. Traditional categories of male and female seem to have been a benefit for us in some ways. To speak about evolution, changes in time, these genetic expressions, has been usefully explained in terms of sexuality. Okay, male and females bringing together, let's say in the case of human beings, so half of our genes coming from our mothers, half coming from our fathers. That's the way sexual reproduction works. It takes two. Now here's a recombination. And this has been a way of understanding just basics about evolutionary biology. And now we have another layer that's coming in based on our current context. And whether or not these categories of male and female are too restrictive, I think we'd recognize they are useful. They tell us something, but I don't think they tell us everything. And what we're recognizing here is that perhaps binary is a little bit too strict. If we look biologically, what is it? Somewhere around 2% of human beings are born, I could use the word sexually ambiguous, biologically ambiguous. They don't fit into that nice binary.
It depends how you define it. I think if it's sexually ambiguous, let's say in terms of genitalia, it's more like 0.02%. But in terms of, say, having sex hormone levels outside of the typical range for your sex, then it's more of a 2%.
Yeah, but then we also have to include in our expression of chromosomes, XXXY. And if we combine these together, we're getting something about 1.8%. of the human beings that are born that don't fit into that binary. Regardless of what that number is, we've done a good job of ignoring that in the past. Now for whatever, 98, 99% of us who fit that binary, it's easy for us to say we can discount that 1%. But if you're part of that 1%, I mean, this is reality that you know. Now, how is this going to be understood and lived out? And I think we have currently a little bit more sensitivity to the recognition that maybe our binary has been too tight. For many cultures, they have built in a third gender. There is, yes, male and female, that tells us something, but then there is another category. And I'm thinking about the work I did with the Muscogee people. They use the term Honan Nuskuba, Honanwa, person, and then Nuskuba in the middle. So the idea here is that it doesn't fit into the categories that we have regularly. And that term is used to account for both people who are homosexually oriented, as well as transgendered, or as well as not quite fitting the expectations for the traditional male and female gender roles. I think that here in the United States, we're coming to recognize that maybe our way of talking about gender and sexuality has been a little bit too restrictive.
Is that separate from gendered language, where in Latin, for example, you have masculine and feminine words, and you also have neuter?
some languages more than others, the so-called romance languages. We're going to see that. But there are other languages in which gender is not part of the kinds of linguistic determinations. I'm thinking about one language. I don't know if I can tell you the one. It is an indigenous language of South America, where the categories are not male or female, but the categories are, that's what has to be defined when choices are being made for prepositions. There's considerable variation here, but I think just even a cursory overview of languages throughout the world, we're going to recognize there's a lot of different ways of dealing with this. These categories that for many of us, we would just accept as natural, turn out to be a product of that cultural experience.
Beyond this binary, before I got involved in the research on puberty and brain development, I was working with an intersex disorder called congenital adrenal hyperplasia. And that's the leading cause of being intersex. So that's about 1% of the population. So that's soaking up half of the variance of this 1-2% you're talking about. And this is a disorder where females are exposed to male typical levels of androgens, of testosterone prenatally. And most of the time it's treated shortly after birth. So they grow up into normal, healthy females, but there are subtle effects on brain development, masculinizing effects of the testosterone. So they have lifelong personality changes. They're more aggressive, more tomboyish during childhood. They're more likely to grow up to be gay, which indicates some role of prenatal hormones in determining sexuality later in life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's all fair. And there would be those, let's say, biological components, but let's not forget that there's always the social components where these biologies are expressed and what kinds of options are available to people. And lots of ways of masculinity and femininity. When we look across culturally, we're going to see, I think it's good to recognize that these differences are recognized throughout populations of people, male-female difference. But what are those actual differences? And there we're going to see some variation.
We're getting closer to my field of development and neuroendocrinology, but to
and we need to get away from that because I'm a little less comfortable there.
Yeah. Back to you and back to anthropology of religion. I don't know if you're familiar with these Jungian archetypes or people like Joseph Campbell who've analyzed mythologies cross-culturally. And one thing that stood out to me is you do get something like gendered symbology there. So often there's something like order versus chaos, and order is traditionally symbolically masculine and chaos is regarded more feminine, or often in creation mythology, you have something like a feminine goddess that gives rise or gives birth to the universe or to male gods. And then male gods are the ones that construct order, create humans and other life or earth or whatever. You see a lot of gendered archetypes. Is that universal cross-culturally?
I think there is definitely the gender dimension, but whether or not it's the male that is primarily the creator, the female, I don't think I'd be willing to say that this is something that we're seeing. Sure enough, there are differences, male and female, but what do those differences look like? Is the sun male? Is the sun female? Is the moon male? Is the moon female? And we don't have agreement cross-culturally there, how we're looking at it. Oftentimes the earth is seen as female. I think it's probably because of its fecundity, but there's other traditions that are describing it as male. Here is a male god body that is being enlivened around us. So it is say that we make those, then as soon as we start getting specific as to what are those distinctions, then we run into problems. Similarly, if we're going to speak about male and female gendered behavior, even in the United States, maybe we can speak broadly and we'll find some patterns, especially if you are forced to, but we have to recognize immediately that there's exception to every one of these. Mm-hmm. And these are not something that are fixed either, but some of these targets are ongoingly changing.
From an anthropology perspective, or from a perspective of cultural evolution, how do these stereotypes or associations evolve and why?
Okay, let's say it's always contextual. So whatever that initial history is and whatever kinds of needs that a society is experiencing is going to determine some of these outcomes. I think it would be very difficult for us to speak broadly in a way that would account for many of these traditions or expressions. Instead, we have to look locally, and then we would have to account for it within this specific area. Let's think about something even, I don't know if we want to speak about, say, female circumcision, or even maybe something like polygamy. The fact that there is a man with multiple wives, or polyandry with a wife that has multiple husbands, how do we account for that? And I don't think we can say broadly and globally, here's the explanation. I think it would have to be always investigated within a particular context. So that time and space, how does it function here? What is it doing here? Why does it work here? How long has this been in place? What kinds of changes have occurred? Rather than simply saying there is some kind of economic benefit to this kind of thing, or some kind of psychological attribute that is being expressed here. Yeah, see, my job as an anthropologist, I always get to say, yes, but, right? So we come up with these statements that we're making, and we're particularly enamored with the exception. We tend to be looking at these minority representations rather than the majority representations. It's not our job to provide confidence. I think it's our job to cause people just to delay it, a little bit more humility, and to recognize that these things we're looking at are perhaps more complex than we imagined.
Some of the effects when you're looking at human development or psychology or behavior, anything, are going to be universal cross-culturally. Others are highly context-specific, or you could argue, depending on the level of analysis, everything is context-specific. And sometimes it seems like people are saying it's random, or just the context could change so radically that the behavior could change. And then other times it's more like there are constraints or predictions that across different contexts, there's still going to be some evolved range of behaviors you would see. So right here, I'm thinking about something like life history theory, where if you're in a high stress, high adversity environment, then development is going to occur faster. Puberty happens earlier, partially due to stress hormones triggering changes in sex hormones. And the evolutionary theory for that is that in a harsher environment where you're more likely to die earlier, you want to have babies earlier so that you can just keep propagating your genes. But then in a safer environment, development can unfold more slowly and you can adapt to your environment and your brain stays plastic for a longer period of time. And on one hand, you could look at that and say, this is extremely context specific because your development completely changes depending on the environment you're in. And on the other hand, there's a meta theory about it that says, depending on the different qualities of the environment, you can predict which direction different things are going to develop.
Yeah, and I think that's somewhat useful. But I think, again, we'd have to recognize it. We speak about something like universals. You recognize that to say universal, that's always a matter of definition. So I could say something like this: every culture on the planet will tell you that murder is wrong. Okay, and we now speak about this as the anti-murder thing. That's a universal. But now it gets to be problematic when we say this. Now, what do you mean by murder? Certainly, somebody may die, but is that murder? If I'm driving home in my automobile and I get a flat tire and I end up striking somebody and killing them, is that murder? We have a different category for this. So we're speaking about something, it's fair to say, the prohibition to murder is a universal. But now, what constitutes murder? Currently, we have this war, apparently, that's going on in Israel and on the West Bank here, Hamas. Is this murder that we're talking about? Is this justifiable? Is it revenge? Is it massacre? Is it warfare? So we have all of these different kinds of assumptions that are going to come into our definitions of this that will then allow us to understand and to go forth. I think that as an anthropologist, I'm particularly sensitive to the context and recognizing that how we express even these universals is going to be tremendously dependent upon the social groups where this is happening and the particular historical circumstances that are going on in order for us to understand. And that all has to be unpacked.
When you're dealing with religious truths, let's say your different moral laws, such as under what conditions killing someone is acceptable, if any, there's a paradox where on one hand, differences cross-culturally in what the religious beliefs say. And on the other hand, religions within a culture by definition is saying, claiming these are universal truths that we all must abide by. And it seems like a lot of the between culture conflict you have is when you have different definitions. So things that are clearly non-universal claiming to be universal. And then there's a massive tension there.
Sure. Yeah, that there is. Maybe that would be worth investigating here for a bit. I don't know if the approach here would be first to try to understand relativism from an anthropological point of view, or whether or not we want to look at a sociology of knowledge, how it is that we go about defining realities for ourselves and then pursuing those. What sounds more interesting to you here?
I think both would be useful.
Okay. Let's start with the whole relativism thing. As I was listening to some of your previous podcasts and some of the presenters there, I was hearing the term relative and subjective, and oftentimes that being used as a way of saying we can't simply reduce it to that. What are we left with if we're going to imagine that truth or morality is left up to the individual? So I think it's important that we would make a distinction between relativism and subjectivism. And let's start with this idea of relativism. When anthropologists use this term, relativism, what we're trying to get across is our standpoint in viewing reality matters. So whether I'm looking from this side or that side, what I'm going to see varies. Now, I think the responsible anthropologists and even, let me say, postmodernists are going to recognize that there's something we're looking at. And I don't know if you want to call that reality. What we found here in our work at Concordia is to make a distinction using terms that are not familiar to people. So we've adopted some usages of theoretical models expressed in Peter Berger, Sacred Canopy. That's one of the classics in the sociology of religion, in which he speaks about nomos, or a worldview, a law, an order. That's literally what the word means, but think of it as a worldview, a view of reality that is constructed by human beings. And we have to contrast that to something else called cosmic. And the cosmic is what is actually like it or not. Maybe I could use this as an example. Let's go with Bigfoot. This summer I was back with my wife's family, and some of my nephews living in Oklahoma are big Bigfoot fans, and they sure will say he's going to appear one of these days. All right, cosmically, either Bigfoot exists or he doesn't. Only one of those is true. And cosmically, it doesn't matter if you believe it or not. It doesn't matter if you are firmly convinced. It doesn't matter if you are completely against it. There is a truth. That truth we may not know, but we're going to be viewing that truth through a gnomic lens, through a lens of experience, through culture, worldview, however it is that you want to say that. Most of the worldviews that have been constructed like to present themselves to themselves and to each other as if they are cosmic. This, our view, is reality, but it's important to make that distinction. Here is a reality, like it or not. And again, how are we going to access that? That's another question completely. But let's first start with this recognition that there's something that's here, and that something is independent of me, and it's independent of my perceptions. I can have perceptions about it. I can have a relationship with it. And maybe those perceptions are going to be overlapping with the reality, perhaps not. But I'm always going to be viewing that cosmic from this gnomic lens. Every culture group on the planet is somehow interacting with that reality. We're not just pulling this out of the air. we're trying to make sense out of this stuff that we're going through. There's something that's here, but what is that something? And that's going to be understood as that gnomic expression, which is highly cultural. All right, now let's think about this in terms of relativities. There is clearly something real, something that we are experiencing. Now, what is that? And this expression of experience is going to be considerably dependent upon from what point of view, our standpoint, our biases, our experiences, our way of making sense. Okay, to say that it's relative means that there's something that's being observed or experienced, but from a particular point of view. Your point of view different than mine, you maybe are going to apprehend that reality differently. How about if I would use an example of a cylinder, okay, like a pop can. Here is a cylinder. From a distance, if I'm looking at it, it's going to appear like a rectangle from the side. But if I look at it from the top, it's going to appear like a circle. So can you imagine two people who are both viewing the same reality? And from the point of view of one, it's the rectangle. From the point of view of the other, it's a circle. And then what are you left with? How are you making sense of this? I see a circle. And the other person says, there's not a circular line on us. It's just these lines here. It's a rectangle. And the other person saying, there's not a sharp corner here. It's all round. Now, how can they both be right in the same way that they can both be wrong? That their perception is limited to their relative position. And that's what we would be saying here as observers of cultural difference, even religious difference. We're going to be seeing based on our standpoint. That standpoint broadly can be spoken of as a worldview or as a nomos. And then that whole, how do these nomoi get started? How are they made? And then how are they maintained is another aspect of this sociology of knowledge that I think is also important.
The cylinder objectively exists. The relativism comes from looking at it from different perspectives. Now, with moral relativism, this would imply that there is such a objective thing as morality, and people are getting at different perspectives of it. But normally, when you hear the term moral relativism, people throw their hands up in the air and say, because it's so different, who are we to say what's right and what's wrong? It implies, what would the opposite of relativism be here? Something like when you claim that there's no cylinder at all, there's just rectangles and circles and who knows what other shape perspectives and no ground truth.
Yeah, I don't know if that's nihilism or what, kind of cynicism, but I don't know that any actual functioning person is going to take that extreme, right? Because I'm still sitting in a chair. There's still something here. I'm still using electronic devices to communicate with somebody. I'm still eating food. I'm still going shopping at grocery stores. There's something. Okay? And we would recognize that. Now, we can imagine a situation where none of that is real, but I don't know how helpful that is. When it comes down to experiences, being human beings, we are interacting with something. Now, what is that something we're interacting with? And that's where we see the differences. In regard to morality itself, I've seen a variety of studies that are trying to identify universals. But again, the problem with universals is a matter of definition. What are you going to count as the same? And what's going to then be acknowledged as different? And these are judgments that are being made throughout. But if we want to speak about some kinds of things that we see consistently, I don't know how else to say it, but there's this matter of fair play. That we can't just be making choices based on how it affects and benefits me without a recognition that it may hurt you. We can't all operate from selfishness. There has to be this recognition that somehow my behavior also impacts yours. Yours impacts mine. So this idea of fair play, broadly speaking, I don't know if broadly is the right word to say, justice, maybe that's going to be part of it, but we would be appealing to something. You can't behave that way and expect me to not have those same options available. So we can speak about moralities, differences, yes, but there's going to be some things that are in common. very much, and I think this fair play would be one of them. But let me go back to something else that we had spoken about with murder. Let's say that here is a universal moral prohibition. Now, what counts as murder? Tied up with those definitions of murder is going to be, how do we view ourselves as opposed to the others? Are they one of us or one of them? So when we say they're one of us, the rules are different than if it's one of them. Let me go to something like Nazism and the murder of Jews. How did the Nazis do this? They treated the Jewish people as something less than fully human. Okay, they put them into a different category, and therefore what they were doing was not murder. Now, if a Nazi did this same thing to a Nazi, this would be seen as murder. Okay, so here is the in-group, out-group. It's a matter of definition, but to who do these rules apply? I think in some ways it's fair to say, okay, every culture says stealing is wrong. What constitutes stealing? When does it become stealing? And I think we're going to, again, recognize that cultures have ways of defining who it is that the rules apply to and who they don't. What are the activities that are being incorporated in this and what are not? I've had conversations with non-Americans in which we're just talking about capitalism. And the way that they speak about it, it's very much the fact that you guys are just stealing. This is really what you're doing. And then go on to account for that. How is it that you can speak about an owner sending these materials to a group of people who are desperately trying to make a living? They're willing to accept a payment of 25 cents for making a shirt. You take that same shirt and sell it to an American market for $25. How can you justify this? That's capitalism. That's the way that it works. Whereas from another perspective, that's going to look an awful lot like stealing. Okay? But this fair play aspect is going to be part of us understanding that all. And I think from a capitalist orientation, we're going to explain why this is still fair, why it is fair for the owner to have what they have and to enjoy those profits. And why it's fair that this person has to make these shirts for 25 cents. And we'll have ways of legitimating that. And this is what we do as human populations.
You see a similar thing with the abortion debate, where no one believes that it's acceptable to kill babies, but it all depends on how you're defining baby. So some people say this is life, and other people say this is a clump of cells. It doesn't count as life until much, much later.
Mm-hmm. Precisely. And the fact even that we would use the term fetus as opposed to a human being. I think about historically among, let's say, the Kuskokwim peoples and the way far Arctic. Historically, they practice infanticide or abandonment. But within that group of people, you have to look at the environmental constraints. Here were normally functioning, loving human beings, just like we would see everywhere. But they're pushed to this point where sometimes they're imagining that the abandonment of a child or an older person is going to benefit the group. Now, within that Inuit community, they don't even name newborns until after they've survived for the year. Okay, at that first year, there's something other than fully human. Okay, and then after that first year, now they're welcome fully into the community. Before that, they were a spirit that may return to that spirit land and then come into a family at some other point. Historically, that was the practice that was in place. How do we understand it? It's tied up again to all of these relative components: environment, subsistence, religion, constraints. And then we can understand this as a human solution to a human problem. We can still look at it and say, that's tragic. That's horrible. They had to do that, but I don't know what other choice there was. Sometimes individuals have to be sacrificed for the good of the whole. I think we can imagine military doing that same kind of thing. We send our young men and women off, knowing that many of them are going to die. But what are they doing? They're somehow protecting the whole. And cultures have to make such choices. Again, how we understand that specific manifestation is going to be tied up to that particular cultural context.
This is making me think of Freudian ideas of self-deception or death anxiety, because one stance could be how you define human life. Let's say in the case of this one-year-old child, is really dependent on the culture in which you're raised. And it's a relative, completely valid way of looking at it, that you don't actually get to the stage of counting as a human who could live or die and the moral consequences of that until your culture makes that happen. But then another way of looking at it, again, the Freudian in me is thinking, clearly it's already alive. Is this just in a very unstable environment where there is a high infant mortality rate? There's this sort of mass self-deception of convincing yourself of this so that you don't have to bear the grief that would be associated with the loss of life. Is that plausible, or is that just me imposing my own cultural viewpoint onto them?
Yeah. Well, I think it's plausible. And I think, yes, you are bringing your own culture to bear in there. But let's think about something again, like Israel and Hamas, what they're going through now. Lives are being taken. So do we have mass deception that's going on and saying, okay, what you guys are doing is not murder, that here is a greater good that's being accomplished. And so it's not like we can just set this aside to some place that's imaginary in the past, but even here currently with living human beings. How are we making judgments about each other? And I don't know if you want to call that mass deception, but I think instead it is a worldview, right? This is the outlook that we have inherited. This is how we engage the world. And with that, we have these consequences that are going to follow. There's something about those lives that are less valuable than these lives. And we're making decisions like that. We expect this kind of fair play among fair partners, amongst ourselves. And then we're able to define some of these others in such a way that, but the rules don't apply to them. Yes, stealing is wrong, but let me tell you why this isn't stealing. Yes, murder is wrong, but let me tell you why this is murder. Or yes, killing babies is wrong, but let me tell you why this isn't a baby.
These in-group, out-group biases seem biologically universal. There's even interesting hormones research on how our brain responds. Say oxytocin promotes in-group care and another hormone, vasopressin, promotes out-group aggression. But how the groups are defined is somewhat relative. So you could have something as simple as you're in the same culture, the same community, the people look and act like you, but you're fans of a different sports team. So that's a sort of group bias that seems superficial. And then you could look at differences in community or nationality and like this whole ascending hierarchy. And religion seems to be a particularly strong one because that can span across nationalities and bring people together. But it seems like the tensions with out-group members as the group becomes more cohesive gets stronger. Is that a solid theory?
Yeah, I think so. And what's fascinating to me is to recognize that in-group and out-group continually change definitions. Who belongs in, who belongs out? When are you us and when are you them? And we don't, yes, there are some consistencies here. Religion can be one of those, but even within religion, are you the right kind of religion? Are you the right kind of us? And some of the research has demonstrated that the closer these religious affiliations are, the more tension is going to be felt. Let's say within religious denominations, let's say some Christian denominations, here is Lutheran. And some of the greatest threats to Lutherans are other Lutherans, because they're almost there, but not quite. And so we have to draw these lines very cleanly. Whereas in other situations, it can be much broader than that. Here you are Christian or here you are a Muslim. That's the important distinction, whatever variety that you are. And in order to understand why is it tension here and there, again, has to be understood within the particular locations, that time and place. Otherwise, we have to overgeneralize, I would say.
There's the saying, me against my brother and I, against our cousin, my cousin and I against the stranger. So there's this idea of nesting groups where on the proximal level, you can have conflict with someone, but then once there's a new out group that's even more distant, you'll band together. And the extreme of this would be like species level. If there was some sort of alien invasion, I'd imagine that we'd forget all of our cultural and religious differences and band together against the new threat.
Yeah. Until it disappeared, right? And then we fall back.
And then refractionate.
Yeah. And I think that is fair. And it's probably reasonable for you to make such distinctions. These seem to be regularly pointed to family, right? That's a really important thing. But now, who is my family? How big is that family that I need to be mindful of? And then also we can imagine contexts in which it's not the family, but it's this particular line coming from the same ancestry. And now this is more important. We divide, but how we divide is extremely varied. But the fact that we do divide, us and them, and who becomes part of us, who becomes part of them. What in American history, at one point, Irish was a separate race, and they were ostracized. There were the biological components. They were given to drunkenness and violence. There was an out-group. But then through time, they become part of an in-group, and now they're bounded together with other people designated as white. So all of these are contextual, historical. Let's try to unpack what was occurring here and how does these awarenesses of historical conditions help us understand that change.
I was just at a talk a few hours ago looking at exactly that, racial assimilation of European immigrants in the U.S. throughout the 1900s. And their predictor variable here was looking at migration of other immigrants more culturally distant, Asian Americans, African Americans, or even just Black Americans coming from the South to the North. And they were comparing different communities, and the higher number of outgroup migration into the community, the faster was the assimilation of the Irish or the other European immigrants. So it's, as soon as you start comparing yourself to other outgroups that are more outgroup, this somewhat similar outgroup in the case of the white Americans to the Irish American immigrants, they suddenly seem more similar and the assimilation happened faster.
Yeah, and I think with Marx, he gives us some insight here too. If we can get the outgroups to fight with each other and to imagine that, to get them to be convinced that the real problem is these other outgroups instead of perhaps this larger economic group that is controlling actually these aspects of life production, means of production. That's another way of accounting for some of these histories that we have seeing repeated.
What is your take on the Jungian or Campbell idea of archetypes, that there are universal patterns that you see in belief systems and they're context specific, but it starts off from this place of there's something almost like a metaphysical truth, like mathematics or that cylinder, which can be viewed from multiple perspectives.
Enculturation into the field of anthropology, I was taught that universal is always a matter of definition. So if we define it in such a way, we're going to find these similarities. The problem with that approach is when we define them as universals, then we fail to see the differences, the exceptions, the nuance here. That is an amazing thing about phenomenology, an amazing thing about epistemology. What we begin to what we expect to see, we're going to see. When we start to define categories of reality, we're going to place things into those categories. Anytime we place something in a category, we have chosen, well, someone has, and we're continuing it, to emphasize certain characteristics. But at the same time, there are characteristics that are being ignored, that in another context, these very characteristics that are ignored become most salient. Any two things can be described as being the same or as different. I hold up $2 bills in front of you. We can describe them as the same. And sure enough, there's going to be these things they have in common. Paper, the shape, the printing, their use, and so on. But at the same time, we could also speak about how different they are, with the different numbers, the different wrinkles, the different ages, likely the different histories that they've gone through, the different microorganisms that are present on them. Any two things could be described as being the same or as different. How do we see them then? And we have our customary ways of seeing similarity and difference. When we're trying to understand these things, we would recognize, say, universals, archetypes, these symbols bound in myths. Yes. But at the same time, there's some variations that are just as interesting and perhaps even more important to understanding what's being communicated by way of that symbol. So do we want to emphasize the similarities, lump them together, or do we emphasize the differences and to split them and to see now what are the important features here?
Do you believe there are any forms of truth that are true regardless of whether you have a perspective to be taken?
Yeah, excellent. Let me go back to what we had, or what I had addressed earlier, the difference between cosmic and gnomic.
The cosmic truths, yes.
Cosmic is true regardless. Okay, and it has nothing to do with you, has nothing to do with me. We could imagine that one of us is in an insane asylum at this moment imagining this all. Maybe that's the real truth. Maybe it is a matrix. Okay. There's going to be something though, right? Either yes or no. And some of these are very complicated. I'm reducing it to this binary here, but let me go back to Bigfoot. Yes or no. And it has nothing to do with your faith, your belief, your certainty. There's a truth. And maybe you'll never know that, but there is the truth regardless. And that would be, I think, what you're asking about. Sometimes that's called the capital T truth. Sometimes it's realissimum. What we found on our campus is to introduce this term cosmic and distinguish it from gnomic as a way of getting to this. So here is the cosmic. Certainly we're interacting with it. Certainly there's something here, but what is that? And we're always going to be viewing it from a particular gnomic lens.
Even to ask cosmic questions, doesn't that require its own gnomic lens? Because you can ask the question, does Bigfoot exist or not? And there can be a cosmic truth to that that's independent of anyone's subjective experience. But then you still had to define Bigfoot to get to the place of determining a cosmic yes or no answer. And this seems to apply to any category, really to any question you can think of. So on one hand, you could say, does this cup exist even if I disappeared and no one could perceive it? The matter would still exist there. But the concept of cup, to have any concept entirely, you need subjectivity. It seems like the only question, the only cosmic question you could have without subjective categories overlaid is just, does matter exist out there? And then you wouldn't even have different objects until you have different categories. You would just have, is there being, yes or no?
Mm-hmm. Precisely. So let me say it this way. Here's my cup. Now, what can I say about it cosmically? And if I do anything more than that, I now define it gnomically. You know, here it is. There's something.
Oh, that makes me think of the first line in the Tao Te Ching. It's like the Tao that you can talk about is not the true Tao. The reality that you can talk about is not whatever cosmic reality underlies.
Yeah. And let me emphasize that I think there's something. And there is something, and this is independent of me. Now, what is it? Now I am speaking to you relatively and perhaps subjectively, but certainly through those gnomic lenses. Here's a way of apprehending it. But there is a truth. Again, that's hard work. There's some cosmicness about this, that it's not just in my imagination. There's something. And what is that? Okay, let me say it this way. Maybe this cup is cosmically just in my imagination. I think that would be fair to recognize, whatever that truth may be. So is this, in fact, is there such a thing as a cosmic cup? I guess there could be. I don't think so. But regardless, I have to apprehend it through a gnomic lens. And that's going to be, let's say, biased, filtered. I'm going to see it from a perspective. That gnomic perspective, well, let me go back to this relative kind of thing. I'm seeing it from a standpoint. I'm seeing something from a standpoint. Now, that's going to be different than from a subjective point of view. And that would be, let's say, my internal life, my subjective individualistic experiences. But we're talking about culture. We're not talking about it being something subject, but it's something relative. Our views of reality, our views of humanity, our rules of murder. Now, there are going to be subjective components to that. I can have attitudes toward these definitions, But these definitions are what provide for me, I guess it has to be called reality. It's the thing that I'm functioning in. Here's perhaps an example. I had a freshman student just a couple of weeks ago. She took her first exam and didn't do very well. And she asked me if she could retake the exam. And I said, no, I'm afraid not. You cannot. According to the syllabus, you get this one shot. Okay, now I recognize I made that syllabus and I could make it differently than I did. I could have written in there, yeah, you get to retake these low performing scores, but I didn't. Now I invented this. I externalized it. Here is a thing, but now it's reality for her. Okay, a grade goes in the book and these grades are compiled and maybe her GPA is low enough that she goes on academic probation. Maybe she loses a scholarship. That's reality, but it is still this relative reality. It's the way of viewing, making sense out of the world. And there are other ways to do it, to be certain. But now this is the shared experience that we have that can be described as being real.
There's cool neuropsychology at work there about how our top-down cortical systems represent meaning from basic perception. So something as simple, you're looking at a test grade and in red marker, A or F. Really, from a visual perspective, it's just a few little squiggly lines that are different, but your entire emotional response will be so different to that because it's a predictive model. It's not just the red ink on the page. It's your whole future that's loaded onto that.
Right. Yeah, good point. Okay, so now one of the other things I said that I thought I needed to talk about was the sociology of knowledge. How do we go about forming these gnomic or worldview understandings? I would begin with the recognition that as human beings, we're unfinished. We come into the world not knowing how to be a human being. A squirrel, a rabbit, they come into the world knowing how to be a squirrel or a rabbit. They have a physiology that is very much environmentally specific for them to go about doing rabbits and doing squirrel. We could speak about a whole lot of that as being instinctual. With human beings, on the other hand, we come in very undefined. We have a kind of a generic physiology that can function very well in all kinds of environments. What we realize today, even in outer space stations or under the water, every continent on the planet, human beings are doing okay. All right, so we don't have that specific environmental constraint. We don't have a set of instincts that tells us how to be human, but yet we have to be. We have to have some kind of system that allows us to interact with that social and natural environment around us. So it's culture that comes in and provides for us the finishing. It gives us a world to participate in. That world that we participate in has been made by human beings. It doesn't exist without us. And that world that we make is now shaping us. That's the thing that forms us into the kinds of beings we are. Had we been born into a different social world, we would likely be very different social people. The kinds of opportunities that are afforded us within a certain social cultural context are going to be different than elsewhere. When a kid, what do you want to do when you grow up? I want to be a basketball player. What if they're in a community, a tradition in which basketball has never even been imagined? What are the kinds of options that are then available? Okay, so here we have this dialectic that can be recognized. We make a world and that world makes us. And that's all because we're unfinished. We don't have this built in. Now we go about the process of building that world. We externalize. We've got ideas that we pull forth. We express. Here are options available. And then some of those stick. Some of those become real things. They are like objectivities, things around us. And then those are what we experience in life. And then those become internalized. Those options, those roles, those realities are now part of our own experience. And then now as that formed person, I go into the world and continue to create society, continue to externalize. Okay, so here's this world that I'm participating in. Now that could be described as that construction to the world. And I'm borrowing heavily here from my pre-acknowledged Peter Berger, which he himself is borrowing from a lot of other sociologists and anthropologists. How do we sustain that world then? We have our legitimations that are in place. This is the way the world works. This is why we do things the way that we do. This is what happens with these chemicals when they come together. This is what happens with these forces. This is what happens if you don't pray. Whatever kinds of ideas here that legitimate that worldview. And then we have institutions that are going to support those legitimations. So whether they are universities or seminaries, day schools or governments, religious organizations, these are in place that support a world that's been constructed. And when we inhabit that world, we're going to feel very firm in the idea that, yeah, this is the world. Even while, from an outsider's point of view, we have to recognize this is a view of the world. It's a nomos. It's a worldview. But yet, the way that we present it to each other is we imagine that it's actually cosmic. We'll tell you that, no, this isn't just a view of the world. This is reality. This isn't just a view of reality. This is reality. This is what's happening. And every society has that tendency, regardless of what the content is of that worldview, it's going to be presented and then maintained in such a way that this is the world. This is reality. And then we find our place within that. And for many of us, we can go through our entire life feeling like, yeah, this is the right way, the only way. And we can explain away every contrary worldview or nomos. We can tell you what's wrong with it from our point of view. And it doesn't take much to recognize it, but they can do the same thing for us from their point of view. They can describe to themselves why this way is wrong. Instead of worldview, that very spiritual worldview, a very ethnocentric, xenophobic worldview, they're going to be able to account for themselves and also for those who differ from them. And we can feel quite convinced that our way is the only way, the true way. So we're willing to give ourselves up to die for a worldview. And those are the realities that are here. The worldview is needing to be understood as that distinct thing that has been created by human beings and perpetuated by human beings. And so that's going to bias, right? It is going to cause people to engage the world in a particular way.
Even other objective truths, like mathematical truths we were talking about earlier, the whole logical system often stems from a few bedrock axioms. Like in the case of math or philosophy of logic, there are these Kolmogorov axioms, like principle of non-contradiction or transitive negation, all of these basic rules from which, once you lay them down as your initial axioms, you get a whole consistent system. But it's a faith-based process in the same way that you're talking about faith-based beliefs in these cosmic, claiming to be cosmic organizing truths. And even science itself seems to be something like a faith-based process, in the sense that you believe there's an objective truth out there, and then you develop a method to discover things. And that only once you have those bedrock assumptions can you actually go about doing science.
And I think that with that comes the recognition that we have to begin with some starting points. And those starting points are always arguable. Those starting points, those assumptions. Okay, I'm going to accept this, and maybe you don't, but you're going to accept something else. And we can't go down any further and be able to defend, accept, but this is the one I believe in, or this is the one I trust. And I don't know that there's another way around it. We start with these basic principles that are arguable, and then we go forward.
Then there's something like a natural selection going on it as well, because you could imagine that you can have any starting place. For example, the question of, is murder right or wrong? It depends how you define murder. If you define it in the right way of anyone can be killed at any time for any reason, then any society that puts that into practice would go extinct pretty much immediately. So there does seem to be some constraint, even if it's not in the objectivity of the belief itself, just in the practicality of it. like a system has to be stable enough that it can exist over a long enough period of time. And then that stability becomes like a meta truth.
And admitted. And I think you could do a good job pointing that out. At the same time, any of these systems that have been developed are continually changing. We have people dying, people being born into. Sometimes we didn't learn the lessons that our elders were trying to give us. Sometimes we reject those lessons they were giving us. Sometimes the contingencies have changed. And so there's going to be these subtle variants that are occurring all along. Choices are being made. Do we perpetuate the status quo? Do we go against it? And we can look at social movements in American history to recognize that here have been some radical changes. The civil rights movement. And keep in mind, there was a trajectory. There was the status quo that was pushing back against that. Yes, it functioned. Yes, maybe it was an evolutionary benefit in such a way, but then things have changed. Or people have changed, personnel have changed, and now there's going to be pushback, try to get the trajectory going a different way. And sometimes it succeeds, sometimes it fails. And that's why these processes of legitimation and the institutions that legitimate are so important, that we can keep speaking, keep conversing, keep reminding each other why this is such an important point of view, even though plenty who would resist.
All of this sociology of knowledge discussion, it almost sounds like a very academic way of describing agree to disagree or allow people to have their own differing belief systems. What is the practical significance of these theories to everyday people who aren't necessarily thinking about it?
Sure. It's a good question. But let me add that other layer, so we can have these variations, agree to disagree, that's only up to a point, because with these social processes that are in place, somewhere is going to be this issue of social control. And that is, no, I don't agree with you, or yes, you disagree with me, but you have to stop talking. And if you don't stop talking, I put you in jail or I execute you. There's going to be those dimensions of social control that are going to be in place that will bias some of these trajectories to make them more likely to survive into the future. It's not just look at all these different ideas we have, but some of those ideas are going to be hegemonic. And this is going to give us the standard going forward. And not only do you have to accept these, but to speak against them is going to be problematic. So that social control aspect. And I think that can bring us back even to the original question you asked about how sex and gender was being managed in this American Anthropological Association meeting, the panels there. It's not just knowledge. It's not just differences of opinion. Then comes that layer of control. And then the rules are different.
The control angle, it sounds Marxist. It sounds like there's a group or power struggle between, it doesn't even have to be classes, it could be any groups, and that one is eventually going to outcompete the other. Is that an oversimplification?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd want to attribute that to Marx, but let's just think about it in terms of power within social institutions. We don't all have equal access to power. That there are some voices are going to be privileged. And there are mechanisms in place to continue privileging those voices. I don't think we have to reduce it to an economic level. There's going to be a variety of forces that are going to make some of these voices louder and heard more often. And some of those voices are going to be shut down immediately. And again, what are the specifics? We'd have to look at the historical examples. But power is not equally distributed. And I, to speak about power, we can even say such a thing as, where's the influence coming from? Some voices are louder than others, and some of those are going to be more socially perpetuated, held up. Hegemony, again, is the word that's going to come to my mind. I don't think that it has to be just classes, but it can be a variety of forces that are coming together to help us account for why some groups have more power than others.
That brings up a question of what are the selection mechanisms for different ideas? As you mentioned, one of them could be social control. There seems to be some natural levels of just some belief systems might die out because they're not sustainable. And I'm sure there are others. And then the question is, are those belief systems or are those selection mechanisms themselves things to base a belief system around?
Yeah. If we would approach this theologically, ontologically, maybe we would imagine that there's some of these truths that are better than others or stronger or more likely to survive. But I'm not going to take that as the approach. Instead, I'm going to be looking at these social forces. And here would be a recognition that the content of, let's say, a worldview of a nomos, that's really not as important as the social processes that are upholding and maintaining that. And if we look globally, we're going to see tremendous amounts of diversity in terms of religious content. What is it that people teach about life and death and living and what's worth killing for and so on? Tremendous diversity. But from a social perspective, what are the mechanisms that are maintaining these, regardless of the content? And we can see religion functions in these ways around the world through time, regardless of the content. So I've been more interested in those processes than I am in the, let's say, the theological content. I don't know that theological content does such a good job of explaining as does the social institutions and processes that support it.
Recently, I spoke with Joe Henrich about this, and we were talking about the cultural evolution of monotheism. And he talked about a bunch of different demographic predictors that aren't that obvious. For example, moving towards more of a nuclear family structure as opposed to a collectivist structure where you have lots of extended family all involved in parenting each other's children. That was one of the things that contributed to the rise of Catholicism in Europe throughout the last couple thousand years. And I'm wondering what are some of these other social forces that led to monotheism in particular becoming globally dominant in the last couple thousand years?
Yeah, you're not going to like this again, because I'm going to say it's so contextual. But I think about the early days of Christianity, even. One of the things we were seeing in that early Christian world, the people who are most attracted to it, some of the more recent historical work has shown that it's people without strong family support, especially single women, older single women. So here's a community of people that didn't have the traditional familial support that the rest of the nations did. Okay, so here are people who are already marginalized. So what do? They come together and form a new community. So that's going to be something that appeared to work. Who is being drawn into these and why are they being drawn? And again, that is going to be extremely dependent upon those historical circumstances. The work that I did with the Seminole people, a Native American group originally found in the Southeast United States, while they were in their traditional homeland, let's think Georgia, Alabama, Florida, they resisted Christianity. In fact, for many years, to convert to Christianity was a capital offense. So they were highly resistant. And it wasn't until they were forcibly removed to Indian Territory, which is now Oklahoma, that Christianity started to take hold. Now, we can speak about the theological benefits of a worldview in such a way, or we can look at those social realities that was happening as well. And I tend to be particularly drawn to those social motivations. When the Seminoles were forced there to this new territory, they lost their autonomy. They didn't have the means of controlling their broad lives, but very few elements of their lives they had control for. When they converted to Christianity, some of those federal forces that were overseeing this new life that they were living saw this conversion to Christianity as a very positive step towards acculturation. And so in many ways, they were left alone. But what was happening is their version of Christianity had a very seminal feel to it. These services were being conducted in that Muscogee language. They were using some of the same terms, perhaps, translating them differently, coming out of their tradition as Seminoles. I think it's fair to recognize that, yes, the Seminoles converted to Christianity, but at the same time, they converted Christianity to Seminole. Their particular version comes out of their tradition. And now this expression makes sense there in ways that even if they identified as Baptists, which many of them do, I don't think they would be recognizably Baptist by their non-Indian neighbors. So people are taking advantage of the opportunities that are there. They are adapting within the parameters that are available to them. We see these very unique expressions. And again, I'm drawn to those social explanations. I think as Americans, we do really well at theological explanations and really good with psychological explanations. But I don't think we are aware of these social forces that constrain. And that's one of the things that appeals to me. And one of the reasons I continue to speak is to hopefully allow people to see that there are these other forces that are affecting their experience, that it's not just what's inside of my head.
That's interesting because you can't have those social forces without psychological forces. And you would think to pay attention to one means necessitating attention to the other.
Yeah. Let's see, who was it that spoke about it? I should be able to come up with his name. But they're actually two sides of the coin, right? Mm-hmm. So here is the individual, here is the collective. And by looking at one side of the coin, we necessarily don't see the other side. And we could begin with either one. And I know that we have a tendency to view the psychological and individual as Americans. And here is this other side that also needs to be accounted for.
And when you frame it that way, that's something I've heard before, that Americans are more individualist than collectivist. So then the flip side to that would be more psychological than sociological.
Yeah, that would be my assumption. Even while we're in both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some years ago, I did my sabbatical in Germany. I was teaching at a university in Northern Germany. And before I went there, my liaison with this German university, she was an American. And she was trying to help me think about what life in Germany would be like. And one of the things she pointed to is that German people tend to be very authoritarian driven and are going to follow the rules. And as the example, she told me how one night, 2:30 in the morning, a Saturday, that she saw an individual standing out at a crosswalk waiting for the light to turn green so that he could walk across, though there was no traffic. He's the only person in the area, but yet following the rules. Okay. This was the story that she told. And I think that goes with the trope of why we can explain the rise of Nazism in Germany and so on. When I moved to Germany, there was something that I found really interesting. First, move into my office, and the office manager, she was a Frau Frankenstein. She was showing me where to put my stuff. She opened a drawer, and inside the drawer was an ashtray full of cigarette butts. And she quickly closed it. And she said, "Oh, is this Gebboten?" Anyway, can't smoke in the office. But throughout my tenure there, my colleagues were regularly smoking in their offices. They didn't cross the walk unless it was a green light, but they smoked in their offices. In the United States, I've been teaching at three different universities. Not once have I seen a colleague violate the no smoking in the office policy. Now, my point is Germans are just as willing to break rules as Americans, and Americans are just as bound to rules as Germans. But which ones are we willing to fudge on? And that's where we see the difference. One particular morning, my wife and I were crossing a crosswalk. We were standing with everybody else. And then I watched the traffic stop. I see that the light is about to change. So I stepped into the intersection early, before I had been given that official permission. A young German boy, maybe 12 years old, on a bike, came riding by and castigated my wife and I for going out before we had permission to do that. Why is this such a strong thing? Here's this young boy enforcing the rule, shaming us for this. And then I find out later as I investigate, in Germany, they have small children, 5 years old, going to kindergarten on public transportation. They have these kids going to school where they're having to make choices about crossing the street. And within this German tradition, here is something that's very important. We need to be role models for the kids. We need to show that. You don't cross the street when you think it's clear. You wait until the lights change. You know, that makes a lot of practical sense. What are the things they pay attention to? Again, in the United States, no smoking in these buildings. People will stand out in the cold and in the rain rather than violate that. But yet, we don't have any trouble with jaywalking. You know, so where is it that we're putting these emphases? And again, I don't think that's predictable. I think it depends upon these situations that we can unpack and we can explicate. But it's really tough to make these global proclamations.
What is it about smoking that makes Americans more collectivist?
I think it's because they're ashamed already, right? That they're thinking they're doing something they shouldn't be. So yeah, you tell me I can't do it inside. Okay, you're probably right.
Also, there's still more of that individualist me focus.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah, and that's a fascinating thing to look at that. When my grandfather, my mother's father, whom I never met, died of emphysema, a smoking-related disease, but he was not a smoker. It's true, he did smoke cigars occasionally and smoked several packs of cigarettes each day, including a pipe, but he was not a smoker. So he was a farmer. Because at that time, there was not a category, an identity of smoker. It was a behavior. Mm-hmm. It was something that people did. He was a farmer who smoked, but now it's become an identity. And with that identity comes certain other behavioral traits. Uh-huh. I find it fascinating that in an American context, we haven't always had gay people. It hasn't always been an identity. For a long period of our history, it was behavior. And you had people who were participating in homosexual acts. And then now it is an identity. And that causes us to see things differently and to think about these things differently. Again, all of these are movable targets.
That shows me how much those gnomic categories have we tricked ourselves into thinking they're cosmic with the smoker Indeed. Thing you just said. I just heard, what do you mean? You just said he's a smoker and letting you finish. Yeah. So normally we're much more on the psychology end of the coin. So this has been great, Jack, to hear from you on the sociology flip side. Thank you very much for your time.
You're quite welcome, Adam. I hope I've given you something that's useful to your listeners.
Absolutely. Thank you again, Jack.